Hi and welcome to another episode of the PS Football Podcast. My name's Sam Steen, and with me to run the rule over another big weekend of the Premier League is Peter Henney. Hi, Peter.
How's it going, lads?
We've got Carl William.
All right, lads.
Danny Ward's there.
G'day.
And we've got Callum Dumble again this week.
Hi, lads.
How's it going, Callum? Right, last week we talked a bit about how City might go the season unbeaten. Most of you said that wouldn't happen, but it looked for a long time, actually, that they might drop at least some points this weekend, but they got there in the end, Peter.
Yeah, it was a different type of performance this week, for sure. The kind of performance that, you know, we're always told when you don't play well and you're away from home, things aren't going your way, to get over the line and get the 3 points, they're supposed to be the types of wins that get you to a league title. It's probably still a bit early for that, but when you consider the Bournemouth game right at the start of the season, I think we discussed it recently, was quite a similar pattern. The other team sitting deep, and it was even later they got the winner. And I think it was the 96th minute when Raheem Sterling got the winner down at Bournemouth. Like I said, similar pattern to the game. City had 80% possession, which is insane, really, in a top-class game of football. But for all the possession they had, obviously, as a United fan, I was watching the game very, very closely, you know, nearly hiding behind the couch hoping that they wouldn't score. But they weren't really creating that many chances. They weren't cutting Huddersfield open. Like, I can't really remember too many saves that Lossell in the Huddersfield goal had to make. But, you know, for all their possession, and they were the ones with the intent to win the game. So they probably deserved it. You know, that's now after 13 games, they have the most amount of points ever in Premier League history, 37 points. So, you know, hats off to them. As Danny highlighted last week, the loss of John Stones did look like it had an impact the other day. They weren't quite as fluid how they were passing the ball out from the back. And I think that's really crucial. When you're playing a team that defends deep, you need one of your back players to be able to step out into midfield and distribute the ball well. I think Vinny Kompany looks like he's back in the team because they need him back in the team, as opposed to being ready to be back in the team. There's a couple of balls he's kind of struggling to get to. The header that he nearly scored an own goal with in the first half, you just wouldn't expect that from Vincent Kompany if he was completely, fully fit. I think City will, brilliant as they are, my honest opinion with City is I don't see too much different with them last season in terms of their attacking play. Maybe they are more clinical this season, but I think the big difference is the goalkeeper and the level of comfort he's brought to his defence, because last year it was all very jittery with Claudio Bravo there, and I think that's really the biggest change with them this season. They had the attack, they pretty much had the same attacking players last year as they do this. I do think, however, that City will drop points in the next month. There were signs of tiredness, like I said, in that performance the other day, and just the intensity and that being a little bit down. And they play 9 games in the next 28 days, City. And for me, if De Bruyne or Silva come out of that team, it seriously affects how they play. And to ask the two of them, especially Silva, who's, you know, what is Silva, 32, 33 now, it's going to be a tough ask playing 9 games at that level in 27, 28 days. There could be injuries due to just an accumulation of fatigue even. I still think City will win the league. They're the best team in it by a country mile. But I just think that the whole buzz around them going unbeaten will come to an end probably before or around about Christmas, just from an accumulation of games, really.
What about it, Callum? Do you think that that's a model, like the Huddersfield model, is one that other teams can take into games against City? I'm sure Jose Mourinho is probably watching and thinking, yeah, I'm going to do exactly that. Or was it just a case that City didn't click, they didn't get the goals, and then on any other day, it could have been 6 or 7?
I think if Huddersfield play like that in every game this season, I think they'll stay up, because they really, I wouldn't say they caused City that many problems going forward, but, you know, at the back, they were quite solid. I think City were looking a bit frustrated, certainly at half time after conceding the goal. But I actually watched the game with two Man City fans, two of my mates, and they were absolutely over the moon at the end, because they said it showed a different side to City. You know, it doesn't all have to be, you know, sunshine and roses and knocking 3 or 4 past teams, and they did battle to the win. And, you know, you could look back to a result like this at the end of the season and say that was a really important one. To come from behind, you can't really think of any this season when they've had to do that, other than when they played us at home. They were 1-0 down, they were a man down, and they managed to fight back and get a draw. But yeah, I thought they were you know, you need to see that from a champion, you know, a champion team. You need to see them battling to results and scraping these sort of 1-0s and 2-1s. And they've shown they can do that on the weekend, even without John Stones, as Peter mentioned. I thought Kompany, we know he's not Pep's type of centre-back. He's not a ball player, but, you know, defensively, there's no doubt, and he's still one of the best in the world, Kompany. And if he can stay fit, he'll certainly do a job while Stones is out. But you could tell after the game how much it actually meant to Pep. He's usually one of their managers, you know, after the game he'll shake hands with the opposition manager, give it a bit of a clap and go down the tunnel. But he was right over to the City fans, and all the players went over, and they looked like they realised that was a big result. And Huddersfield beat United at home, so very, very positive game for them, and the two lads I watched it with were over the moon. They thought it was a huge result.
No, absolutely massive, and I'm sure the chasing pack will have been gutted, really, that happened. But let's talk about them then. Liverpool and Chelsea, that was a cracking draw, really, and Salah kept up his run. Danny, is there any more to say about Mo Salah?
No, he's been a breath of fresh air, as Harry Redknapp would like to call him. I think he's been fantastic signing. He's got a little bit of everything, you know. He's got serious upper body strength. He's small. He's the sort of player that can maybe nip under a defender's arm and retain possession. He's very calm on the ball. He's quick. I wouldn't say he's the tricks wise. I wouldn't say he's the most skillful player in the world. He's not going to Rabona it and flick it over your head or anything like that, but he's direct, and I'd say for a fullback or a centre back, because he does play in between the lines quite a lot, I'd say he's a bit of a nightmare, because he runs straight at you. And watching the game on Saturday evening, himself and Hazard were on a different planet, I thought, to anyone else on the pitch. A lot of people thought it was a really entertaining game. It was an entertaining game, but I thought it was a game really lacking in quality. I don't think anyone, bar the two I mentioned, covered themselves in any glory. Liverpool's midfield, the shake-up from Klopp for me didn't really work. Both managers were trying to probably negate what the other manager was going to do, but in doing that, they both nullified what each was going to do, because I'd say Conte didn't think Klopp would take Mane and Firmino out of the side, and I would have thought that Klopp was pretty sure that Fabregas would have started. So in the middle of the park, I thought it was lacking a lot of quality. Reading a lot of newspapers saying they thought it was a cracking game, and a lot of people thought it was a game that Liverpool maybe just shaded. If it was on points, Liverpool might have just won it, but neither side, I think, did enough to really win it. You're kind of watching the last 20 minutes saying, okay, Liverpool, this is a big 20 minutes. Can you see it out? By hook or by crook, it doesn't matter how you do it. Can you do it? The confidence that it'll give you to keep a rampant Chelsea. Chelsea have been scoring a lot of goals of late. If Liverpool had managed to keep them out, the confidence for the whole team, the defence, the keeper, the fans as well, it would have meant a lot to Liverpool. But Liverpool just find a way to shoot themselves in the foot. It's a goal that you look at and go, yeah, he was lucky, you know, and it was lucky. It was a cross, 100%.
Oh, he meant it, Danny. He meant it.
All right, yeah. And it's the difference between good sides and really good sides finding a way. Liverpool don't, they're just so naive. They just seem to not find, they seem to just shoot themselves in the foot. It doesn't matter how the goal comes, you're always thinking, oh, they're going to concede here, they're going to concede. And it doesn't matter, you can't, even if it's a lucky goal or if it's a stunning free kick or if it's a moment of brilliance from someone, it still leaves that same feeling in the pit of the stomach as a fan after it, that they haven't been able to find a way. My big problem with Liverpool these days is they don't have any ruthless bastards. They've no one in midfield that will feign an injury. They've no one that will take a booking for the team. They've no one that will, you know, just hoof the ball. They've no one that'll take a card. They've no one with game savvy, you know, game mentality, winner's mentality.
This is something that you've been saying for ages, though. You know, there's no kind of nastiest, there's none of these little kind of just professional fouls and tricks that people learn over time, though. Like, but that wouldn't be something that that must be coming from Klopp, though.
I think so. He's such a nice guy. Like, there's nice guys always come second for me, you know. The two biggest bastards, wankers ever in the Premiership managers are Ferguson and Mourinho, and they're two serial winners. They don't give a fuck if people hate them or they've got no morals. They don't give a shit. They want to win.
They thrive off it, Danny.
They're obsessed by winning. Obsessed. And I'd say Jurgen Klopp, I'd say, can go home and switch off from football a lot easier than a Mourinho can, than a Ferguson can, because I don't think he has that built-in nastiness, you know. And no one likes winners, and that's just fact, you know. People don't like them. People, you know, when you don't go and watch a comedian or something like that, and it's some brilliant, handsome, successful man up there telling you how he got the girl, it's a fat bastard who can't get the bird that everyone's laughing at and going, "Oh, that's great crack." No one wants to hear about it. But the same thing goes with managers. The same thing I think goes for managers. I don't want to hear about it. "Oh yeah, I'm a nice guy and I've done this and I think, oh, there's more important things in life than football." Of course there are, when you take yourself and your head out of the fact that you're watching football. But I'd much prefer for Klopp to be an absolute prick that I couldn't stand if I couldn't stand going for a pint for him. But if he was taking home league titles, and I think he needs to instill, I think, look at the signings that Liverpool are being linked with. They've Naby Keita coming in the summer, you know, another nice player who's going to, I think he's going to be an unbelievable signing for Liverpool. But where's the nasty sign? He hasn't signed a bollocks yet. He hasn't signed anyone that knows how to disrupt the game, the flow of a game. As I said, I don't give a fuck if Liverpool players take a dive, take a card, pull a shirt, you know, whatever you have to do to get over the line. Man City don't seem to have those sorts of players, but they've enough about them, because they're a better football inside than Liverpool.
Fernandinho, maybe,
but they don't have many, you know. But you'd look around a lot of other teams. Chelsea, plenty of game now, so you know what I mean. And it's vital. It is absolutely vital when you're playing against a team who you're up against for at least the top four spot. And you've 20 minutes to go, and you've nicked a lead in what's a tight game. You have to be able to see it through. And after what happened on the Tuesday against Sevilla, they didn't see it through. And it doesn't matter how you don't see it through, and if you're a bit unlucky or the guy didn't mean it and they got it. You need to find a way. You can't just keep relying on excuses. You need to be able to find a way to deal with it and to see the game through. And until Klopp and Liverpool sign a few nasty fuckers, we're gonna be having the same conversation for the next year or two.
Carl, back to the game then. Have you got anything else to add on that? William, Danny says he didn't mean it. Did he mean it?
Did he fuck, lucky bastard? Typical Chelsea. Typical Chelsea goal and nick a point. The only thing I would say, I don't know. I've only watched it a couple of times. Can Mignolet get a better hand to that? A strong hand and push it.
He looked like
the bar,
he was breaking his back to get there.
Yeah, he was. That's the only thing. You kind of look and think, oh, he got fingers to it. Could he push it over? But I think Danny's right. Basically, the game wasn't a great spectacle. It was just a shame Liverpool, you know, got caught. But what Danny says there about gamecraft and that, I think I've said it before about Spurs, you know. I think Spurs have the same kind of problem. We just don't have those players that when it seems to matter and you just need to do something to get that point or get that win over the line. Again, you know, I think Danny's the same there. He said, you know, you'll be hearing the same thing for Liverpool for a couple of years. I think you could hear the same thing about Spurs for a couple of seasons. It's so key to have those players in a squad who, when a push comes to shove, can know to say to people, right, we don't do that here and we don't do that. We sit here, we don't do this. We, you know, if you get it there, you just put it out for a throw-in up their end. Like Keane would have done for United, I'm sure, all those years ago. You can't imagine him having messed about when United were winning 1-0 with kind of 10 minutes to go.
No, but I don't just blame the managers, because managers now can't rip players out of it the way they used to. Everyone's got agents in their ear and all that, and you have to put the arm around the shoulder, and that's why Klopp is good in that sense. He can put the arm around the shoulder and that. But these lads, it's very frustrating as a fan when you're watching these lads. The more the money goes up, the more power they have, the less a manager feels he can say to them, because they're so vital and they're such assets these days. And it's very frustrating as a fan when you're watching your team and you just want your manager to fucking ball them out of it. Just rip them out of it, you know. Or a player, a fellow player. that's when I think the onus is on the players themselves, because they probably know that managers are kind of in a precarious position, because they can't just go and rip players out of it, because players will throw their toys out of the pram and it becomes a big issue for the club. But your captain can, and a couple of senior players at the club can. Liverpool and Tottenham, I think, Carl, you probably agreed, are both quite young sides with not many players that have won a lot, been there and done it.
I think you've hit the nail on the head. We both got the same problem. We both got naive players, in a sense that, as you say, until they start winning a few things and realise, actually, do you know what? When it's the 85th minute and we're one up, don't fuck about with it.
Yeah.
Just do this and do that. But as you say, right now they've got this mentality where it's like, no, we'll still play. We'll play.
Yeah,
we'll,
yeah.
Oh shit, we've been caught out on the edge of our own box, you know.
And they'd have to understand that, like, those 5 minutes where fans don't give a shit about pretty football in those last 5 minutes. They don't. We don't give a fuck.
Just get rid of it.
We just want those 3 points where we can look back and go, geez, that was a great game, even if it wasn't a great game. We are so. Listen, fans are so fucking short-sighted. They just want the 3 points. I like the fact that Liverpool play a lovely brand of football. I'd rather they play dour fucking paint dry stuff and win something. And I think there's a place in every team for a manager to say, all right, and a manager should see that, okay, I'm going to get this 32-year-old. He's past his best. He's well past his best. He's not going to play every week, but to have him around the dressing room. And Liverpool's owners don't seem to want to buy players of that ilk. And you don't see Tottenham spend the money on older players. I know Llorente slightly older.
We don't, because there's no sell-on value,
the manager has to be able to at least have one of these luxury lads around the dressing room. You know what I mean? Who's someone that's respected, feared, might only play every third match. He might play half an hour here and there, coming to the end of his career, but he's nearly there as a manager within the group of players.
I think it was an entertaining game, but kind of, I agree with Danny that it wasn't high in quality. It's just, you always knew, because it's Liverpool, I'm not taking the piss here, Danny, but you always knew something was going to happen.
Conte was
actually very, very defensive in his approach. I agree. Salah and Hazard were the two best players in the pitch. In the first half, it was a joy to watch the two of them at times. And I thought Salah actually was crucial to that game, because just after half time, he caught Hazard. It was accidental, but he caught him in the back of the calf, deep in Chelsea's half. And Hazard was limping for the rest of the game. And I think that kind of affected Chelsea, but. I think it was around 75, 77 minutes. Conte emptied his bench. He brought Willian, Pedro and Fabregas on. And one of my mates rang me and he was out. He said, oh, what's the score? And I said, it's 1-0. There's 10 minutes to go, but there's more goals than this. Either Liverpool were going to break forward and score, or else Chelsea were going to score, because they had that many attacking players on the pitch. And that's the way it went in the end. But I just think it was entertainment, even though it was low in quality, because you just knew something was going to happen in the game the later it went on. And that's what kind of kept you on the edge of your seat. But I just wanted to throw a stat there, Danny, that I saw about Salah the other day, just to sum up what this has turned into an unbelievable season that boy's having, because everybody knows he now has more goals than every Liverpool player since Suarez in the league. But when Suarez had that 30-odd goal season, 2013-2014, he had 31% of Liverpool's total shots on target. And Salah now has 32% of all Liverpool shots on target this season. That's unbelievable. He's not a centre-forward either. That's just crazy. It's all about the movement with him. It's like Raheem Sterling. Raheem, you were saying that Salah doesn't run at people that much, but he doesn't need to, because, like they highlighted about Sterling the other day, Sterling doesn't dribble much either anymore. It's all about that movement, that, you know, letting a defender think you're going one way and changing direction. And Salah especially, it's all about that inside to out run, where he goes kind of in between the left back and the left centre back. And it's really obvious he's going to do it, because I don't know how many goals he scored from that exact run this season. And everyone, like, they study video evidence or videos of opposition teams meticulously nowadays. So everybody must know he's going to do it. But stopping it seems to be a different scenario altogether.
Pace. You can't stop pace. That's simple as that. I'd like to see how quick. I'd say he's right up there with Bellerin's and anyone in the league as the quickest player in the league. He's absolutely lightning. And as I've mentioned it a few times about his relationship with Coutinho, I think if Coutinho had a better day on Saturday, Liverpool would have won the game maybe comfortably. But Coutinho was very poor. I'd always put Coutinho and Hazard in the same bracket, but I have to say I was really, really impressed with Hazard. He's, again, small, stocky, nippy, and he just can't get near him. He's right up there with, outside the bracket we know of the Messis and Ronaldos. I'd say he's knocking on that door. But I saw an interview with him there. I don't know if anyone saw this interview. It was on Sky Sports there a few weeks ago. And he was asked, you know, like, what do you want and all that? Do you want to be the best player in the world or anything like that? He's like, no, I'm not really interested in that. And all the pundits that were there after, I think it was on Soccer Saturday, they're all...
Yeah, that annoys me.
Yeah. I'd be absolutely devastated if I heard that, you know what I mean? Like, here's a kid that has the potential to be, you know, when Messi and Ronaldo are coming to, kind of, sort of coming to the end of their careers, here's a kid with a chance to be the best player in the world, or one of them. He's not that he's not really that arsed. Yeah, no, I can understand, you know, you don't want to be showing off and being loud and brash and saying, I'm going to be the best player in the world. But you can still say, listen, I'm trying. There's plenty of improvement. I'm trying to be the best I can be. And there was none of that from him, which would anger me now if I was, you know, his manager or his teammate or his owlad, you know what I mean? It would piss me right off.
Did you see, he did another interview there, I think it was with the Evening Standard, after the Liverpool game, and he said that he doesn't try in training either because, to be fair to him, he's the most fouled player in the Premier League since he came to England.
Yeah,
and I'd say his legs are black and blue because, like him, he's stockier than Salah, but when he's so hard to knock off the ball, he's constantly getting fouled. And he said he does be black and blue after every game, so he takes it easy in training during the week, just saves himself for the games.
Well, listen, I tell you, that's the beauty of having a great talent. Like, your managers obviously afford you that rest and say, listen, you just wrap yourself in cotton wool, mate, you're grand, just keep a certain level of fitness and then we'll let you at it.
Right then, let's move on to, Arsenal just about managed to get over the line against Burnley and Spurs were held. Arsenal, well, that makes them go above Spurs in the table. So all this talk of the power shift in North London, it seems to be maybe not actually happening. Carl, Peter, who wants to start on this one?
I really think the Spurs team over the last few years has been brilliant and I love watching them play. But I do think, and I can't be, like, I'm kind of amazed the way even the ex-Arsenal players, the whole media is caught up in this thing of a power shift. Because I know Spurs are probably on the up and Arsenal have dropped a bit over the last few years. But to talk of a power shift, like, I think Spurs have about 10, 15 years before they get close to what Arsenal are. The last 20 years, Arsenal have won how many leagues, how many trophies, you know, able to attract players like Sanchez and Ozil. Okay, maybe they're going to leave now, but even, you know, their name across Europe, across world football, Spurs have a long, long way to go before they get anywhere close to that. I personally think that's not taking anything away from how good Spurs are at the moment, but if you look at the bigger picture of the club that Arsenal actually are and what they've achieved over the last 20 years compared to Spurs, you know, until, like, I don't want to go down that road. Like, I don't like when pundits are saying, oh, Spurs didn't win anything, all this stuff. They still have a great team, and getting in the top four is harder than it used to be. But still, like, you can't say there's a major power shift until you can show people a few trophies and you can show people that, you know, these big, big players want to come and join you, in my opinion.
Carly, is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I can disagree with Pete there, to be honest. You know, we've had a couple of good seasons now.
Oh, you're going to get penalties on Twitter this week.
I know, but it is true. You know, if you take your Spurs specs off and someone said about, you know, asked you that question about two other teams, you'd just say exactly what Peter said. You know, until Spurs potentially either win a title and win a few cups, where suddenly now, you know, it's like, yes, these are the real force in English football. And as Pete said, you know, potential stars of the game want to come and play there. Then, yeah, you have to agree. It's like, we're doing well right now, and we've probably got a better you know, a better start in 11 than them, and over the last couple of seasons we've done well. But to kind of say that now the power has shifted and Spurs are the main side in North London, I think that would be a stretch too far, even for someone like me who, you know, hates and despises Arsenal with a passion. But you can't deny, as Pete said there, what they've achieved over the last 20 odd years under Wenger. You can't knock it, really. You know, some great sides there and some great trophies brought home. A season unbeaten. I don't think many people are going to be able to say they've been able to do that. But, yeah, I can't disagree with Pete, unfortunately, as much as it sticks in my throat.
Callum, do you think maybe the reason that Arsenal decided to stick with Wenger, even after all of the pressure and with them falling out of the top four and all of this, was maybe because of the resurgence or, you know, the growth of Spurs? And then when they looked over at United and saw what happened when Fergie left, that they really dropped out and things went really bad. Do you think they're just afraid that there could actually be a proper power shift if Wenger left? Do you think that that's why he's still in the job?
I've never looked at it that way, but now you say that, it could be one of the reasons, because as an Everton fan, like, you see Arsenal, I know Arsenal are a massive club, but you see them complaining every season when they've only finished in the top four and won the FA Cup. You know, I'd kill a man for that. So it's hard for me to have sympathy, but yeah, it could be a lot worse for Arsenal. It certainly could. You saw what happened with United once Fergie left, and that could possibly be one of the reasons they've kept them in. But it just with Wenger now, I don't think anyone, even one of his biggest fans as an Arsenal fan, could say they're going to get back to the heights they used to be at with him. But yeah, Spurs have got a long way to go before, you know, there's any talk of a power shift, because probably now in terms of quality they're a better side, but there's a lot of catching up to do in terms of trophies to win, and, you know, just finishing above them for a couple of seasons, you can't talk about a power shift. But Spurs are still fighting on three fronts this season, so you've got as good a chance as anyone as winning some major honours. So we'll have to see what they can do over the next couple of years.
I think another part of it might as well be, you know, the amount of money that Spurs are willing to not just spend on players, but pay their players. You know what I mean? Can you really be a big club if you're not willing to pay your players to stay there? You know, they're all susceptible to another club coming in and taking their best players at any time.
You've got some really, really quality players, but you look at City get all this credit for being top of the league, but they've spent more on players than some countries have on the defence budgets. You know, it's absolutely incredible the amount of money that they can spend, and Spurs, they just can't match that. And they've got some wonderful players, but, you know, if you want to attract the top talent, there's only so much the Champions League can do for you. You've got to give them the big money. You've got to give them guarantees. You're going to continue bringing big players in. So they're just lacking on that front at the minute. They've got everything else. They've got the big stadium coming. They're consistent now in the Premier League, fighting for the top four. It's just the money is a real issue.
No, I agree. I fully agree with Callum there. We've seen it at the moment with the Danny Rose situation. You know, here's a guy. He was happy at Spurs a few seasons ago. He's now the best left back, or was before the injury, the best left back in the country. And if he's seeing players in his position, or even the other side, like Klein, who are now on 120 odd something grand a week, while he's sitting there at 60 grand. And it's like anything in work. If you went to work tomorrow in whatever job you do, and even if you was on benefits, if you know there's someone next to you in the same circumstances doing the same job as you, but they're getting double what you're getting or triple, you will want that. And if there's teams out there prepared to offer it, you'll go eventually, because the lure is you want the most for what you can get. And until Spurs can either match those sort of salaries, or they really need to, you know, if they're winning leagues, then you can see players potentially being happy to sit there on that sort of money, because they're the best side in the land. But again, it's not many teams will start winning leagues when they're not paying the best money, not bringing in the best players. And City can blow Spurs out of the water. You know, Spurs can offer 30 mil for a player, City can offer 80 for the same player. You know, it just can't work. But you can't do it on the cheap.
Carl, what do you think of Dele Alli? Because I'm looking at him lately and it looks like he's only shown up in the Champions League lately. Brilliant against Dortmund, brilliant against Real, but everything I've seen before and in between, he's been lackluster, you know what I mean?
I mean, I've had this discussion tonight. I've put a tweet out there tonight because, you know, there's a few Spurs fans crying out for Dele Alli to be dropped. I have a slight issue with that because, to me, even though he hasn't been on his game as much, you'd say, this season as last season, at the same time, he's played 16 games this year and scored 7 goals and got 4 assists. Now, that's still decent return for somebody who apparently is not playing well. And you compare that to the likes in our side of Eriksen, who, I've said it week in, week out, and I'll say it again. The guy, if he's on his game, brilliant. That happens once every 5 games. And I'll tell you now, if you offered me Ali playing poorly or Eriksen playing poorly, which one would I have in my team? I'd take Ali all day long, because even in his bad games, he can get an assist, he can nick a goal. He's got that threat about him. Whereas a player like Eriksen, when he's having a bad day, he just goes missing completely and just doesn't want to be near the ball. You know, when he's got it, it's just a quick sideways pass. Let me get rid of this. Whereas someone like Ali, he might not be playing well this year, but I'll tell you now, he's still looking for the ball. He still has an effect on games. And yeah, it's not great, but I'd also sit there and say, when you can't rest players like this, you will get burnout eventually. Spurs are hoping that we've got 11 players that we can play potentially for 60-odd games a season, and we can't really afford to be without them, because what we've got in reserve ain't anywhere near that quality. And that's probably one of our biggest problems.
Well, that's probably the thing that's holding them back from being considered a big, big club. You know, like the power shift that we talked about. They're doing it on a shoestring, definitely. And they're doing it like by the skin of their teeth with everything.
Definitely. Definitely. We've got no one. And Saturday proved it again. You know, I was there. It was depressing. But again, you're looking on the bench thinking, who can we bring on here that might inject some life into this? There's no one there that you can go, oh, if you bring him on, he'll change a game for us. You know, Llorente, just, again, another brilliant Spurs summer signing as a striker. You know, Deadwood got him probably 5 years too late. But there isn't. There's no one you look at there that inspires you and thinks, oh, well, we can bring him off the bench. And that's why players like Ali, I think, are just burnt out at the moment. You know, they're not getting a rest. They're also not being challenged. And this is another issue. While the likes of Ali and Eriksen are not going to be challenged and they know they're safe in the starting lineup, naturally, the performances are going to drop at some point, because you need that competition to think, if I don't perform, this bloke here will get in. And if he plays well, I won't get back in. And we don't have that. And again, all top sides have competition for places.
Right then, let's move on to United. Peter, it wasn't pretty, but they managed to get there in the end, and it's a huge 3 points when you look at the other results.
Yeah, whatever time it was, maybe half 4 on or half 5 on Sunday, it was starting to look like an amazing 3 points when it looked like City were going to drop a couple. But, you know, with Spurs dropping points and Liverpool and Chelsea drawn, it was all about the results this weekend. The word to describe United's performance, and it's not been the first this season, is probably stodgy. I know they have a lot of attacking players there, but it just isn't. There's not much fluidity to their play. Lukaku's badly out of form at the moment. He looks like a bit of a lump up there at times. There's, you know, I've defended Lukaku, and I still think he'll score the goals that he was ultimately signed for. But when you compare the likes of you know, the touch and the link-up play in the first half, I thought, by Morata in the Chelsea game, they're just on completely different levels in terms of actual footballing ability. Zlatan coming back into the team, maybe he just needs a rest. I'm not sure. He's played a lot of games. No, it wasn't a great performance at all. And it's a big, big few days coming up for United. Obviously, Watford tonight, it's kicking off now in a few minutes. And then Arsenal away before City the following week. So we'll know an awful lot more about this United team at the end of that period. But I think we talked about it a couple of weeks ago, and I think it's true. United don't really seem to me, this United team, especially in away games. The home form's obviously amazing, 100% record, only conceded 1 goal, brilliant. But away from home, they don't look too convincing. And I don't know who said it a few weeks ago, but if they go one down away from home, you, even as a United fan, I kind of go, oh, a draw is all we're going to get here. You know, they don't really seem to score enough goals away from home. It'll be interesting to see where they stand, and but I kind of have a feeling that this United team this season is going to be a really, really good... I think they'll get top four, but I think that we're going to be a really good cup team this year again. I hope I'm proved wrong and things pick up, but at the moment, there's just a bit of a pattern with the stodgy performances. I know they've banged in four goals at times, but I'm just not convinced about us going forward, to be honest with you.
Right then, we'll go to a break in a minute, but first it's quiz time. Right, who won last week?
Yeah, me.
Danny, right. Bit of an interesting format this week, so it's sort of one answer or the other for some of them. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to toss a coin. So Danny, who do you want to go against?
Carl.
Going against Carl, right. So for the fantastic audio game that is tossing a coin, do you want to go heads or tails, Danny?
Heads.
Heads. Right, you'll have to take my word for it. It is heads. So, you get to answer first, okay? It's not a calling a name situation. You get to answer first. Which is higher, Leroy Sané's assists in the league or Antonio Martial's goals in the league this season?
Which is higher? So, Martial's goals or Sané's assists?
Yeah.
It's got to be Martial.
It's wrong. So, Carl, you're through to the next round.
Yes.
Well done, Carl. You played a fucking blinder, mate. What a performance.
Six assists for Sané and five goals for Martial. Right, same situation on the other side.
Sorry, in his whole Man United career?
No, this season.
No.
Oh, this season. Sorry, I thought it was the whole career.
Right, then, it's same on the other side. I'm going to go with Callum. You get to go heads or tails because you're the guest.
Tails.
Oh, it's heads again, right? So Peter goes first. Peter, which
I like the way we can actually hear the coin in the background there.
Peter, which is higher? Watford's goals for or goals against?
Oh, that's tight because they conceded six against City, didn't they? Yeah, they conceded three or four against Liverpool.
I'm going to go against.
That's wrong.
Fuck's sake.
Callum goes through. They've scored 22 and they've conceded 21. Very, very close though. Right. So for the final,
I like this new...
Yeah, exactly. Very easy for you, Callum.
Can I just say, do either of the lads know what to do once they get to the final? Is this the first time?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, who knows?
Right, that's the same format, right? He's going to ask you a few questions. Don't let the pressure get to you.
This time now, you do have to say your name, okay? You have to say your name and then give me the answer. So,
panic stations.
I know, yeah. Two clubs share top spot for most yellow cards this season. One is West Brom. Who is the other?
Callum? West Ham.
It is West Ham with 29. Oh, well done. Oh, what well, a call. Very good.
Wow.
Everything
ever
going
to win in this year.
Points to Callum. That is fantastic. Right. That's it for this half of the show. We'll be back after the break. So, as usual, we will be bringing out our Premier League prediction podcast on Friday, where we go through all the weekend's games and look at some of the best bets available for the games. And with that in mind, we just wanted to tell you about the Beat the Bookies app. We spoke to the creator this week, and he said that what they do is analyse two teams and then simulate the game 10,000 times. This tells them how often things happen and the most common scorelines. It's pretty cool. They sell that data for £5 a month for over 1,000 games over the course of the month. And if you want to know more about it, go check out their Twitter page, @BeatBookiesApp. Other than that, just the usual. If you like the show, subscribe on iTunes, SoundCloud or Stitcher. Like, comment and share it around, as all of that really helps more people to find the show. And if you want to get involved, if you've got any questions or comments on the stuff that we've been saying, or if you've got any suggestions for Prick of the Week, just drop us an email at info@psfootball.net. Back to the show. And we're back. Let's talk about Everton then, who are in a bit of a shambles. It's funny, on the prediction podcast, I was talking about this game and I said that it mightn't be a bad bet to put in under 1.5 goals because neither team were scoring any goals. Just the five goals in the game then. Callum, do you want to talk us about this and maybe talk about all of this talk of Allardyce coming in?
Yeah, it was just... Sunday was just another one of countless abject performances this season now. David Unsworth today. There's been a lot of stuff going on today with Everton. David Unsworth did the press conference this morning ahead of the West Ham game, and he's just said he's basically blated a lot of the players. He said that they're not giving anywhere near enough for the club, and he's right to do that. David Unsworth has been thrown under the bus, and he's obviously frustrated. But what's actually been said this evening, Paul Joyce, who's the Northern correspondent, sports correspondent for the Times, he said he expects Everton to appoint Allardyce at some point tomorrow. Now, there was only really one other name mentioned in the shortlist today. It was Paulo Fonseca, who's the Shakhtar Donetsk manager. But at this stage, you know, you've got 50, 60-year-old men saying this is the worst they've seen Everton, certainly since the 90s when we nearly went down a couple of times. I just think it'd be a bad time to bring someone in like Fonseca, who he could be a wonderful manager, don't get me wrong, and if, you know, if he's available in the summer, then yeah, that'd be great. But I'd rather we'd still be in the Premier League in the summer and then be able to reassess. And you know, he's not a stylish appointment, Big Sam. You know, a lot of Everton fans aren't happy with it, but you know, he's the type of guy who can whip a team like this into shape. He's going to have to be given a bit of money in January, and there's a bit of an argument going around that players won't be keen on joining because they don't know how long he's going to be here. But you know, if they're thinking about that, if they're thinking, well, if Big Sam wants me and then he goes and the next manager doesn't, you don't really want players with that mentality. You want people to be joining the club because it's a chance to play for a big Premier League club, a vision to improve. And if the manager does move on, you need to be prepared to fight and show the new boss that you belong here. So I think that's a bit of a myth that he won't be able to attract any decent players. I think he'll attract the certain style of players, you know, with the strong mindsets, which is what we need at the minute. Because he's always struck me, Sam, as he's a manager who, he'll be like a father figure to you if you're prepared to run through walls for him. And if not, then he's got no time for you, and he makes no, you know, he makes no excuses for that. And what we do need at the minute is players who are prepared to die for 3 points. And I think Sam, given time this season, because it is looking like it's going to be in, and given a bit of backing in January, he will be able to whip us into shape. But there's, you know, there's these other things I've been seeing today from Everton fans. They want football played in a certain way, and I mean, the only football I want to see as a fan is winning football. And Danny touched on it before about Liverpool not having enough bastards, you know, in the team. We for the last few years under Martinez and Koeman, it's been too nice, you know. It's all fancy and trying to play this football, and there's been no real, you know, buggers who are going to get in the referee's ear and, you know, give someone a little pinch and stand on the heels and stuff. And I'm personally relishing, you know, a bit of these shithouse performances, so to speak, you know, going away to teams and battling for something. And you want teams to see Everton away on the fixture schedule and think, bloody hell, not this today, you know, Big Sam, you know, we're going to get kicked about the place. We don't want to play them. So I think it's going to, in the long run, it's going to be a good decision. There's a few who think it's a bit of a panic appointment because we're only obviously just about still in November. But if you look at the stats, we've conceded the most goals of any side in the league this season. That's 28. Now, no team has conceded that many goals at this stage of the season and not been relegated.
You've got 9 games between now and January. So bringing somebody exactly in who's going to change things up or do something that's kind of complicated is going to be... You could be fucked by January, whereas Big Sam will come in and just organise things, you'd imagine, quite quickly.
Absolutely. It's realist Evertonians realise it's a case of need and not want with Big Sam, you know, because we are in danger of sleepwalking off a cliff. You know, if the fans are too proud to realise we need help, we need specialist help, which is what Big Sam is, you only have to speak to Leeds and Villa fans to realise just how damaging it can be to sort of, you know, ignore the issues and try and just, you know, try and do it in a different way. It's, I'd be quite impressed actually with Bill Kenwright, because I'm not his biggest fan. Mashiri, yeah, I like the guy. It's not been your typical managerial pursuit, but I would be quite impressed if he bit the bullet and just said, yeah, we're in trouble, we need someone to help us. And I think the Everton fans will realise come the end of the season it was the right decision at the time.
what would you look at then beyond the end of the season? Would you have him stay in there next year, or more just come in as a firefighter, keep you in the league, and then pay him off?
Well, it depends, because it's how well he does. You know, if he manages to get us up into the sort of, because there is a long time to go. If he gets us up into the top eight, it's going to be hard to see the board letting him go. You know, he will have earned, I think, a chance at a full season with us. You know, if things don't go as well as that, there is a lot of Everton fans now. We've got the money, possible stadium, obviously on the way. They want some young manager, maybe Marco Silva or that Fonseca I was on about before, which I'd be up for. You know, a young manager like that who's going to come in with a vision and sort of turn the club around and turn it into his project. But I do think if Sam does a good job, you can't get rid of him in the summer. He will have earned a crack at a full season and having a full pre-season under him. And he's a results orientated manager. So I think we'll be fine on the big Sam.
Well, Cal, can I just ask you what sort of length of contract do you think they're going to offer him? Is it going to be a 6 month or a year and a half, or? There won't be anything over a year and a half.
Well, they spoke to him, didn't they, a few weeks ago, and I think they were just sounding him out, really, because they offered him 6 months. They didn't want him to make too many radical changes behind the scenes. I don't think they were offering him a massive amount of money. They were just saying, we want you in till the summer, and we want you to keep us up. Now, I think since then, we've lost about 5 games. Unsworth, as I said today, he's finally seemed to have not cracked, but he's not happy at all with how the players have reacted under him. And I think what Bill Kenwright's had to do is sort of go cap in hand to Big Sam over in Dubai and say, listen, we really do need you, Sam, and you know we're willing to come back to the negotiating table and you know tell us what you want. And
well, they're going to have to give Palace a few bob as well, are they? Or does that come out of Sam's? I'm sure it won't be coming out of his pocket, obviously. But
I wouldn't expect so. Yeah, that was a clause. I think if he took another job up before next summer, they were owed $2 million. But you know, I think we paid about $8 million to get Coleman from Southampton. So and we were offering big money for Marco Silva. So we're not afraid to spend, but we need someone to spend it a bit more wisely now.
So I just want. Ask Callum as well about another man who's kind of who's there at Everton at the moment. It's Steve Walsh, who was kind of hailed as this like talent spotting messiah because he signed, what was it, N'Golo Kante, Riyad Mahrez and Jamie Vardy for $7 million, and he's been integral to all them players that were brought in over the summer. Do you think he should get the bullet?
Well, he's getting a lot of criticism from Everton fans on certainly on social media, but it was, I think at the time everyone was happy with it because obviously his record, he brought in Kante and Mahrez and Vardy, but we brought him in and then, I mean, obviously he signed them players on a budget, so giving him massive amounts of money, it sort of defeats the object because he seemed like someone who was pretty adept at working on on a shoestring budget, and we'd give him all this money. And he's not, you know, he's not shied away from spending it. The only signing we've made this summer, you could really say, has been somewhat of a success. Is Pickford? You know, he's spent big money this
he's
summer.
He's been busy anyway, hasn't he?
Well, he has. Yeah, I don't know what he's, you know, he's taken on himself, but he is certainly not a very popular man with the Everton fans at the minute. And I don't know what his future. I mean, apparently he was. Suggesting Big Sam for the job, so I was going to say, you know, if Big Sam comes in, he might have other ideas about his director of football, but with him being trying to cozy up to Sam before he comes in, he might just survive. But he's going to have to earn his bread in January and pick us up a few players.
Yeah, it's an interesting one though, isn't it? I think Everton are maybe in a slightly different situation because they really do need rescuing, and Big Sam is a bit of a rescue artist. But for a lot of clubs, when they're bringing in new managers, you know, there's a lot of talk in the press and amongst sort of football men about how Johnny Farner and these guys are able to come in like Silva and stuff like that, and that they're holding back British managers from getting these jobs, you know, young managers coming up, that they're not getting the jobs because of these guys. But actually, when you look at it now, Pardew's just gone into a job. Pulis will probably get the next job that becomes available, be it Swansea or whatever. Moyes is in a job. Hodgson is in a job. It's actually all the old British managers who are getting in the way of these young managers coming up. Does anyone else agree with that? Has anyone got any points on that, Peter, maybe?
Yeah, it's definitely a really valid point, Sam, because, you know, I think it was when Claude Puel got the Leicester job, you know, there was people sending out tweets like the debt of British coaching and all this kind of stuff. And, like, you're 100% right. One of the main blocking factors to young English coaches is that when a job becomes available in the Premier League, it just seems to be the same old cabal of managers, like the Pulises, the Pardews, the Hodgsons, the Sam Allardyces. In fairness, Pulis and him genuinely do what they say on the tin. The rest of them, you wouldn't get it in any other walk of life. They all get sacked from jobs because they weren't good enough. They flew around for a few months working on TV, and then they walk into another well-paid job.
It's a madness, great fucking really. Gig, isn't it? I mean, you get your payoff at the end of it. Pardew's, I think, would still be under his 6-year contract at Newcastle.
Yeah, it's great. Moyes is still technically under a 6-year contract at United as well. And we all know that them contracts get paid up in full when they leave. So,
not in Moyes' case. Moyes didn't get the full whack.
No, Moyes walked, didn't he?
Because
Mike Ashley was behind.
Moyes didn't walk. No, there was a stipulation that Man United had to.
Had to qualify
for the Champions League in his first season. So that's why they sacked him just when it was mathematically impossible for United to make the Champions League.
But anyway, going back, because I think this is kind of a wider debate that gets touched on a lot. In terms of everyone's always saying, oh, give the English, young English or British coaches a chance. Because, you know, sometimes I don't like the way people slip into the whole kind of, oh, these, you know, Johnny foreigners coming over and taking our jobs. Whenever I push people to say, well, who are the really talented young British coaches? Normally the stock answer is Eddie Howe, although he hasn't been linked with any jobs lately. So you see that his run of form with Bournemouth up until recently has made his stock drop quite a lot. And I agree he is a good coach, but outside of that, I don't really see that much great talent there. I definitely say there's lots of good English coaches, but I wouldn't say there's that many elite level coaches. The guys they're bringing in, the foreign guys, they have impressive CVs for a lot of the time. You just have to look at the whole furore over, you remember last season, Thompson and Morrison going crazy about Marco Silva. They wanted to give the job to Gary Rowett just because it's like the Unsworth thing. You have people in the media bigging him up because of his nationality and his personality. Like, that's not right, you know? And there's too much at stake in the Premier League. Like, you're not just handing these guys the keys to your club. They're not just football clubs anymore. They're multi-million pound businesses. So you can't just give it to some young lad because he's from the same country and he has friends in the game. It's just, that's just madness. So I think it's, and like you said, with the British coaches, I think a lot of that is kind of the money thing, because there's so much at stake now to stay in the Premier League that chairmen or owners, they're looking and just going, who has a track record of keeping clubs up? They're not looking, it's not like years ago you could bring a lad in, and Ferguson took 4 years to win a trophy at United. You'd barely get 6 months now. So it's just the way everything's changed with the money, with TV, with the way things are covered. You just can't afford to take the risk anymore to give inexperienced people the jobs a lot of the time. And if you have a foreign lad with an impressive CV, or you have the likes of the Sam Allardyces and Tony Pulises, I can definitely see why chairmen go with them, because they know what they're going to get. But it does block younger people getting a chance because of that kind of, it's just a merry-go-round really of them saying 5 or 6 managers.
It's getting pretty boring now, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like it's.
No, it is.
Who else is there, Danny? Really?
I know, but Jesus, I'm not. I don't know. You know what I mean? I know, like, of the young coaches in Liverpool's academy and people like that. And I always want to know, what's the difference between being a successful manager and being a successful coach? Because I know down the line, like, I'd say Alex Ferguson, when he was coming to the end of his career and all that, he probably didn't take as many sessions and that as he would have done.
No, he didn't, and he had coaches.
He had coaches. So, yeah. So you, people don't want managers anymore. They definitely don't want managers anymore, because managers are there to manage clubs. And there's probably only I'd go out on a limb and say that Wenger is probably the only manager left in the Premiership, and the rest of them are coaches. Because every other coach, if you think about it, I'd say every other coach is out in the training ground.
Benitez maybe.
Now, yeah, but I'd say Benitez still does a lot of work on shape, an awful lot of work on shape. And I'm not saying Wenger doesn't, he's not out in the training ground, he is, but he's the only one I'd say that has an influence over the whole club, the grand workings of the club. Because I don't think these big owners, these big wealthy owners, have enough trust in a 40-year-old kid who's good at football. What the fuck does he know about running a multi-million pound organisation? Absolutely nothing. So you have started seeing in the last few years just the titles of what we always call managers. They're just either coaches, head coach.
It's the European model, Danny, isn't it? Yeah, really? Yeah. Where you have a sporting director who picks the players, and the coach is just in charge of the team. But
you have to be worldly and smart to know how to run a club, and you have to.
They're too big now, though. You know.
Yeah, they're way too big. Now, Wenger, I'd say, is a very smart man who could mix it in anyone's company. You know what I mean? I don't think he's just, like, listen, he loves his football, but I'd still say he's enough about him to know a little bit about politics and a little bit about current affairs.
You're not
going to say Alan Pardew, who's the head of a massive company that's floated on the stock exchange. Do you know what I mean?
No, you're definitely not, because you just heard that name and fucking shares are dropping like, you know what I mean? Like a horse knickers. It's for sure. So I do think there's a change in that respect, because as Peter was saying, there's so much money involved that you're just going to give someone a 2 or 3 year contract as your coach, and we don't trust you that much, so we're going to get 3 or 4 lads sitting around a fucking table who are going to buy your players for you. So you're now just a coach, and if you're there for 10 or 12 years and you want a bigger piece of the pie, as in you want shares in the company and all that sort of stuff, you're going to have to make sure that you've got a few strings to your bow, I suppose, where you prove that, yeah, I can actually run this club, I can run the whole academy, I can run all that, you know. But that's a lot to take on for any man, especially a 40-year-old football man, because let's not forget, they're not notoriously the smartest cookies in the jar.
More than likely, they stopped going to school at 16. You know, so they haven't done anything beyond that would make them qualified to be the CEO of a massive company, having not worked their way up through it. You know what I mean? Especially people who can do that, but you can't just drop them in at 40 and say, "There you go, do it."
What do you like with balance sheets? You know what I mean?
Yeah, but lads, listen. This is kind of the thing. It's because up until about 20 years ago, I saw an interview with Glenn Hoddle recently, and he was saying that, like, when he went to Chelsea, for example, this was only like, say, 95 96, he was still in charge of whether the tea lady could order a new kettle, whether the washing lady could buy a new washing machine or whatever. And now they're just monsters, like, they're businesses, they're not football clubs anymore. So I don't think it's possible for any manager to run all that anymore. And I think in time, I think it's the older schools, the Allardyces, the Redknapps, because when they would have started their careers, they would have been in charge of every piece of a club. So they would find it difficult to give control to the likes of a director of football and stuff. But I think as time goes by, it will completely change in the Premier League to the European model, where it's, you know, transfer committees and directors of footballs. The coach, yeah.
Because you don't see it anymore. You don't see the power struggle. I remember Benitez had it when they were talking about bringing in, I think it was Damian Camoli. You've seen it in a few places. I'd say coaches are pretty much told, this is what you're here for. Don't get above your station. If there's going to be someone here signing players, you might get a say in it, but you're not going to be the king of the castle, unfortunately. And I think that for the money they get, they just have to swallow that. Just go, yeah, that's grand, I'll take it.
Do you think that players or managers have to come from football? You know what I mean? Like, I know that Mourinho didn't. Like, but just what I'm saying is, like, can you imagine if there was, for example, a university degree or master's or something like that, that you went in and you did, as part of it, you did all your badges, you did contract law, you did psychology, you did all of the basic kind of business management, all of the things that a person would need to be in that kind of position, and then went in at a low level in the club and worked their way up. So that, say you went out of school and just went in to do it, that by the time you're 35 or something like that, you could be managing a club.
Yeah, because the players would be like, "Who the fuck are you?" and show us your medals, kind of thing.
That, yeah, exactly. Kind of but they
as well.
Could they get to the management point and then have the ex-players being coaches below them, for example, like kind of in the States, like, you know, you when you see the coaches of the American football teams, more often than not, they're fairly small guys who would get absolutely murdered even when they were 20 out on the field. You know what I mean? They're not. They're just more thinking about it and planning it in strategic and coaching ways rather than actually being able to go out and do it.
When I was growing up, the old saying was always that great players don't make great managers. You know, Ferguson, Wenger, Mourinho. Ferguson was a football player, but not a very good one by all accounts. Wenger was, I think he studied, he was an economist or something. So that kind of leads into Danny's point about him being good at everything. And Mourinho didn't play professional football, but it has changed nowadays because the likes of what Guardiola has done, and you look at Zidane at Real Madrid as well. So I think even with Mourinho at Chelsea, I think a couple of players, Hazard was saying, well, when Conte came in, oh, he understands me, get better, because he was a player himself. So I think it's very difficult for anybody to not have been around top level sport, you know, a top level sporting team for most of their adult life, to just come in at 35 and go, right, I've been studying this in university.
But no, I'm not saying that they arrive in, but say like you came out of university, haven't done your master's or whatever, in all of these things at 22 or something like that, and then you go in as a low level coach and work, you stay at a club for a very long time working your way up. You know, you've done all your badges and you're there working your way through the system. I don't know, if it's just an idea, because like, as well, a lot of players now as well, when they retire, they're retiring as millionaires. You know, it's not like when Redknapp retired, or even when someone as recent as maybe Sean Dyche retired. You know what I mean? They won't have the millions that a lot of players will be retiring on now, that they won't never have to work again.
It's definitely have a point.
I don't know what the answer is. I'm just saying, is it something?
See, the German, I was reading an article today in the Times. It's about the German and the Bundesliga managers. And Hoffenheim, they appointed Julian Nagelsmann last year. He was 28 years old. He'd never played professionally. And, you know, his CV consisted of, I think it was a degree in sports science, and he'd had a few stints coaching at youth level. And then there's so many of them in Germany. It's Tedesco at Schalke. He was 31 when he took over in the summer. He'd never played professionally. There's another fella, Florian Kohfeldt. He's 35. He played youth and then he just went straight into coaching. And they seem to be taking risks in Germany on young managers, but it's because, as Danny mentioned before, they're just the coach. They really don't have any other say in the club. They don't have to have massive contracts. You know, they're getting these big opportunities at clubs. They're getting relatively small wages compared to managers over here, and they're just being told, go and coach the team, bring your ideas in, do what you can. Everything else, transfer policy, youth policy, you know, the general direction of the club, then decisions are made by the people upstairs. And it's having relative success in Germany with the young managers, but again, it says in the article, you know, how much success is it having? You know, how many German managers are going, you know, to the Premier League, to La Liga? You know, Klopp. It doesn't seem to be having a massive success, but it's certainly something they're trialling in the Bundesliga.
Callum, I think there's a really big benefit to that in a way. What you were saying about the coach not having a big say over the club's general direction and the youth policy and stuff, because we're all agreeing that they're big businesses and stuff now. But if you're to go with that old school model, that this guy comes in and he controls everything, that's an awful lot of power to give to one man. And you're probably better off having like a 10-year plan for where the club wants to go and how you want to run your youth team. Because if you give one manager the power over that, if 1 year, if it it's not working out with the first team, he'll get the chop. Another lad comes in, rips up the youth structure again, says, okay, we're going to go in this direction. So you can kind of see the benefit to having certain parts of it completely kind of separated, you know what I mean?
And consistent as well. It's kind of a bit like Swansea, because for a long time they were swapping out managers, but everything was staying the same behind the scenes. It was just the coach was coming in. And Southampton as well, yeah. And then when they started changing things, it's all gone to shit. Anyway, let's move on. And we mentioned Spurs earlier, how they dropped points. Carl, do you want to talk about this? Is this the end of the title talk, and is it just time now to sort of knuckle down and concentrate and making sure that they finish in the top four? Or is it even as bad as that?
I think the title was always going to be tough anyway for us. The same things were going to hold us back as they have the previous years, as we've mentioned already tonight, the lack of depth that we've got other than the starting 11. It was just another poor performance, really. Just, you know, it was just flat. As Danny said earlier, you know, we've no pace in our side whatsoever. And, you know, people say, oh, yeah, but teams are just dropping deep. It's like, yeah, but with pace can beat, you know, pace can beat people. Pace can get in behind a team that even want to sit back and defend. And we just don't have none of it at all. It's just the same sort of Wembley performance. And this time, you know, we got what we probably deserved against even, say, Palace, you know, because Palace probably should have nicked that game against us at Wembley. They were the better side. So I think title was obviously, you know, a long shot anyway, but that's definitely gone now. I think we are just fighting for top four this year, to be honest, to try and stick around in that top four while we're away from obviously having a home. But there's no guarantees right now that when we move into our new stadium, we still won't struggle for the first year there, because it's not White Hart Lane and it's not what the players are used to. So anyone who's just hoping that when this new stadium comes along, we'll be back to the sort of Spurs side that we were last year at White Hart Lane, you know, you may still have an issue there, because that's going to be new. It's going to be the bigger pitch. But this is what happens if you don't invest properly in your squad in the summer, I feel. And I think for us it's just consolidating top four again this year, and maybe try to nick the FA Cup if we can, you know, and just go as far as we can in the Champions League, you know, quarters, something like that, you know. And hopefully we, as long as we stay in that top four. But the way the form's looking at the moment, and as we're recording, we're one down to Leicester and not looking very good at all. So yeah, who knows? Hopefully this is not the start of a run of wretched results coming up that sees us finish fifth or sixth at all, because then we will be in trouble.
Yeah, interesting times. Right then, we haven't done quotes in ages, actually. So we're going to do Pirlo this week. Obviously, he's retired recently. He's an absolute legend of the game, but mostly we're doing it because it's an Italian accent. So Peter, away you go.
Okay, it's been a while. Okay, so this is just he's not just a great footballer, he's something of a philosopher, was Andrea Pirlo. So here we go. The best idea. Oh, fuck, my phone. Wait.
Luigi's back.
No, because I had it. You know, the phone went. The screen lock. Come on. The best ideas come about in the moments of a total concentration, a state when you can reach only when a shitting. Smashed it.
You did, yeah.
I smashed it. You got it.
Let's go, Carl.
So the one the Pirlo quote I quite like is the only great English midfielder in my career was Apollo Scholes. He had elegance in him. Others were just pretenders. I don't know whether that was French or fucking Italian.
I don't know, but I feel like I've been wooed.
It was like a tour across Europe.
Danny, what have you got?
I don't know if I brought this up before on the pod, but it's I don't know if I did, actually. I only read it there a little while ago, but it was on Roy Hodgson calling him a dickhead. All right, so here it goes. Luciano Castellini thought I was okay while Roy Hodgson mispronounced my name. He called me Pirla, a term used in Milan dialect, roughly translated as dickhead, perhaps understanding my true nature more than the other managers. We went through four coaches that year. I'd wake up in the morning and not remember who my coach was.
I mean, it was very good at the start.
Yeah, I always struggle to keep it going. Ask me, missus. Really good at the start.
Callum, what about you?
Yeah, it's this one's regarding pre-match warm-ups. He wasn't a fan of them. And his quote on pre-match warm-ups was, it's nothing but a masturbation for conditioning coaches.
That's pretty good. It's not bad at all.
That's it's a classic quote.
It is. Oh, God, I don't know who to give it to. Carl, I'm going to give it to you because I just something about it, you know, you're like the...
It stirred their feelings, really did it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, just give your ladies my number. I'll help you.
Maybe you should just do all the podcasts in that voice, actually, Carl. Right then, let's go on to the John Terry Prick of the Week. Who's it going to be, Peter?
I'm going to go with Gary Cahill this week. I don't know if anyone remembers it from the Liverpool game, but in the first half, the corner came in and the ball broke kind of to the edge of the six-yard box. And I know he's not left-footed, but like he could have just swung the left foot and smashed it into the roof of the net. But he's probably the least talented footballer on the pitch, and he tried to go for a Rabona with his right foot. And then he realised, what the fuck am I doing? So he kind of backed out of it in the end. And I just thought, know your place, Gary, you fucking prick.
What a prick. Carl?
What a prick.
So for me this week, I think I'm going to pick the good old FA. With the Lukaku incident and the not giving out a retrospective ban, because I think this is probably the one thing that infuriates all football fans when a certain, you know, one player gets banned for doing something and then a week later or so another player does something just the same and nothing happens and you get told, no, we're not looking into this. So I don't think they're just fucking absolute pricks, the FA, you know, how they can let these sort of incidents go. My prick of the week of the FA.
For a whole bunch of reasons as well. I'm sure we could do another whole show on that. Danny, what about you?
My prick of the week. I'm going to go with another Chelsea player. I'm going to go with Willian. Just for spoiling my Saturday with a goal he didn't fucking mean whatsoever. A few people think maybe he did. He definitely didn't. And he's a prick. And Chelsea are a bunch of pricks. So they're my pricks of the week.
No argument there, Callum.
Mine is Morgan Schneiderlin. He's been absolutely terrible this season. His attitude's been disgusting. He fell out with Unsworth a few weeks ago. I think he got sent home from training. And if you look at the, I think it's the third goal, Charlie Austin's second on Sunday. It's embarrassing. He doesn't even make an attempt to get back. He's a fucking prick and he's an absolute crab. And I never want to see him play for us again.
Nice.
Yeah. Well, yeah, heartfelt. I suppose, Callum, we got to give them to you because there's nobody feels as passionately about their prick of the week as you, I think.
No.
All right.
I'll tell you what, fucking Sissoko is going to be fucking in there for me this week after tonight. I'll tell you now. What a
two now, Carla.
Trina United. United got absolutely battered for 20 minutes under Trina up. Like, battered.
Right, I think I'm going to leave this in. Right, first off...
No, don't. You can't leave that again as a fucking start. You know what I mean? No, because people would go, you're always bashing United. I'm not.
Just shows that we all kind of half watch the games and do the podcast.
I know. I'm fully watching.
Right then, just a quick round of applause for Morgan Schneiderlin. What a prick. Yeah.
Well done, Morgan.
Absolutely.
Well done, Morgan.
And that's pretty much it. First, though, I just want to say that as of next week, there's going to be a bit of a change to the podcast. Just tune in next week. Nothing's going to change. We'll be here on the same days every day, but big changes in the PS Football universe. Other than that, thanks from me for listening. Thank you, Peter.
Cheers. Catch you next week, lads.
Cheers, Carl.
Cheers, guys. Can't wait for next week now.
Thanks, Danny.
Thanks, lads. Cheers.
And thanks a lot, Callum.
Cheers, lads. Pleasure.
And we'll see you next time.